Blog Talk Radio.
On a man-made lake, there's a sheet of thin ice. We're unskilled skaters, cut figure eight twice. That's 16, uncut, direct from the coast. Head on assault, the result, death by the boat. In the vote, it spoke about the average lost permission that was seen by a king in a prophetic vision. Like a plane crash from a bomb blast. Special broadcast, slot time with Comcast. They kept the jury quiet and now the riot performed. While satanic man now hanging his dorm. I swing on you fake radio personalities with Wuxia ratings. With hypes behind casualties of five shots. With low pressure water gunplay. Instantly slap your five like it's Palm Sunday. I fashioned the first tool from the elements the earth used and built it to a complex network of communication. You're up against a hopeless situation. I screen every vehicle through enemy observation. Swarming unpredictably, we spread terror, increase the fog significantly, change the era. Check my wind pattern, it's heading west. Success is freedom, but failure can mean death. Human sweat and aim shovels. Dig up debris and rubble. Permanent damage caused by the double. You, now who, cowardly urge you to merge through and think the workers to serve you? The Sonic Marvel, who just dropped the next novel. Worldwide, rap elite, more than Marvel. It's a countless amount of MCs I saved, and them same niggas wanna swindle those gifts I gave.
Moments most sacred. Both species, they lay naked in the tombs of the oasis. Think back on niggas I ate with, spend the day with, guns we play with, niggas I relate with, we broke bread. I heard through a vine, niggas work for the feds, sent out secretly to take my head. I laid back and meditate to the words they said. Skipped town 4 months in group of dreads. Had a friend tell my family I was dead. Returned at the last fall of the autumn leaves. Operate the plan accordingly, in case the feds are recording me. Sign all documents, using forgery, cause just a mere thought of me. I'm like Solomon, spoke bluntly, told the world I'm black and comely. Howled from the grave, hunt me, the smell of death upon me. I dwell in the hills like Gandhi, been in the presence of mad peasants and old kings who sold everything on the quest for God's divine. Slept in caves to get a clear mind, who prayed three times when the moon lit and when the sun rise. I met dwellers in the desert, talked to shepherds, been in the mouth of many leopards, felt the death kiss of Satan's mistress. Walked through vacant districts, performed religious, studied pagan scriptures through philosophers and physicians on a cure mission, who hardened their hearts toward the weak, sick, and afflicted. Candles lit, gambled with a bitch who made me love her when I touch her. Saw paws, high claws, bees with sweet honey in their mouth, have bitter stingers at their tail. Walked through the chambers of death, take a hold on to hell. Embracing her was like embracing the third well.
Tonight to interview this brother here. He's been around for a very long time.
matter of fact, he's the one that started the whole Black Age movement. I think it was back in 93 when he started, 1993 to be exact. And, you know, a lot of us have followed suit after, you know, he brought it to the public. You know, we've been doing this thing now in Philadelphia, Atlanta, and Detroit as well, and it's starting to spread elsewhere throughout the United States, which is a good thing because we need more venues and events like that that really showcase our talents, because we're not really being showcased in other shows or the mainstream shows, because it's like we represent 1%, maybe 5% of the population of a comic book convention. But I'm going to read something real quick. This brother is internationally experienced. He's a Chicago-based artist. He's also a professor. He is known for his advocacy of the growing Black Age of Comics movement. He stated as a major market illustrator, he became an indie publisher in 1981 with Only Studios, NOG, and that is the protector of the pyramids. I'll have him speak more on that when we get him on the line. He is also a former art therapist and an art educator from Chicago Public Schools. Only refers to his creativity style as being rhythmistic. His art illustration expands the notion of blackness while addressing the impact of the mainstream exploration and genre making. He is known to act more as we instead of as me. His operation is known as Only Studios. Let's get him on the line here. Brother Only, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Hear you loud and clear.
Hello?
Brother. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Wonderful. Cynthia,
fantastic.
Are you there?
Fantastic. I appreciate the intro.
Oh, yeah. I got to give you your grand intro, dude. You know, of course I got to do that for you. After all,
man,
you're the man for the Black Age, the father of the Black Age.
Look, fantastic. It's an honor, a privilege, a challenge, and an opportunity. You know, opportunity,
yes,
in what I call creativity, culture, and commerce. You got to have all three.
Correct, correct. You know, I'm a firm believer in that myself. Even when I first started doing dreadlocks, you know, I came in, you know, with thinking of it as the artist aspect. But, you know, you can't go out the world being a what they call a starving artist. So that's where the commerce comes in.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm with you 100% there. So how have you been,
exactly,
brother?
Exactly. Man, I've been great. I've been busy. I've been retooling since I retired from being a Chicago public school educator.
Okay.
The idea of the Black Age has grown slowly but exponentially. We're active in an autonomous way in more than 60 markets in the United States. I challenge people everywhere to come in and check us out. Our products are more independent, of more value for the speculative market, because most independent Black Age publishers print what's called a small press run. So we're still pioneering down the line. Many years when people start collecting, they're going to find greater value in collecting our products as opposed to what's taking place in the mainstream.
Correct.
I think the contemporary mythology that we're harvesting and expressing is fresh, unique, opulent, and it provides what I call a positive fantasy life, because you can't have a positive reality unless you have a positive fantasy life. They go together.
Well, that's true. You know, you got a whole hour to tell us all about that.
Hour.
The first 2 minutes.
Okay. Look,
but it's
all
the
good.
Deal. You know, we appreciate that, and we appreciate you.
Yeah, it's the deal.
But I wanted to ask you.
Commerce. Go ahead. Go ahead. Ask me.
I wanted to ask you, who were your earliest inspiration, and do you have any present influences, and what inspired you as far as to get into the comic book field from the fine art field?
Okay. My earliest influences man, childhood, I was raised in Chicago by my grandfather. Now, it's really ironic. Number one, he was a Pentecostal pastor that created biblical charts to visualize the Pentecostal mission. You're talking Pentecostalism in the late 1950s when it was like a fringe form of theology connected with Christianity, the sanctified church, the black community, and things like that. So I'm looking at these charts as a child, when I say child, like 3, 4, 5, and he's doing his depictions of biblical stories, Old Testament, New Testament, and
right.
Of course the people look like us.
Correct.
So I get that imprint. I started drawing probably when I was 3. My uncles, his sons, were artists, but ironically, you know what people say about preacher's kids, they were also leaders of one of the first successful street gangs in the city of Chicago, black street gangs. And check this out. The name of the gang was the Egyptian Cobras. So I'm getting my imprint, right, that here we got an African nation and
right.
an African animal, and this is the gang. And, you know, they started me to draw it, and so, you know, they had comic books. They would turn me on to that. So one of my first, actually, this is no lie, my first gig as an artist was to draw the insignia for the Egyptian Cobras that then they took to a knitting mills and had varsity sweaters made. They were crazy. Had varsity sweaters made for the leadership with this insignia on the back of it. So, you know, I'm probably 9 years old.
Right.
I'm thinking, man, that's so cool. I'm going to be an artist forever. So that kind of got me going between being in Sunday school, watching Pops, my grandfather, the late
right.
Samuel Davis Phillips, doing his thing. And then we got this other thing going on. So that right there put it in me that this was just life. I didn't see a distinction between charts done to express the word of God, unfortunately. I didn't see a difference with the gang insignia. You know, magical thinking when you're a child. You're just thinking if you
right.
could draw, it's art, and you kind of build on that. And so in high school, one of my classmates was a vocalist. Her name was Yvette Stevens. You all know her as Chaka Khan. And so, you know, I'm kind of jealous because she's bragging about how she's doing studio sessions with, you know, different groups. And I'm like, shoot, I want to draw for money. And so
right.
I started looking at how to be a professional artist as in being an illustrator. So when I got out of high school, I started an artist guild called BAG. You know, you're talking the height of the black culture movement.
Mm-hmm.
So we were called BAG as in Black Arts Guild.
Like during the 70s?
60s. I graduated from high school, well, technically 70s. I came out of high school in 69. I would have been working in downtown Chicago when Martin Luther King got murdered and, you know, the riots ensued. And also during the Democratic Convention when SDS and the hippies were rioting and the police was cracking their heads. So, you know, I grew up with all that, and it sort of galvanized the kind of political worldview and a need to be involved in a way that could affect positive change in the community, because you think of the 60s, man, I mean, President Kennedy got capped. Everybody got capped. I mean, the 60s
right.
were insane. President gets murdered. Civil rights leader gets murdered. Fred Hampton
right.
gets murdered in 1970. You know, it was just
right.
out. So, you know, I'm thinking as an artist, what can I offer? So part of it turns to this concept of images, positive images, to elevate a consciousness to a world stage appreciation of what black culture coming out of the Americas has to offer the world. So I saw fine art, illustration, commercial art, and, of course, comic book illustration as all one and the same. It was just a matter of function. Like, if you did it for somebody and it went in their crib, you call it fine art. If you did it for somebody else and it was on their album cover, you call it illustration. If it's the cover of your comic book, you call it comic book art.
Right.
So I never really left that way of looking at things.
That basically molded you into the artist that you are today for the most part by incorporating all of that into one.
Yeah, it laid the template. I had clients, I went to the School of the Art Institute. Before that, I went to a community college called Olive Harvey. I'm a big proponent of community colleges. And I think it's a fantastic step for anyone that's smart enough to decide to go that route. When I got to the School of the Art Institute, I was freelancing. So, you're talking Chicago at one end of North Michigan Avenue, which is our downtown strip. You had Playboy, so I was working for them. I would do artwork, like when Playboy would do reviews of musicians, I'd do the illustration to go with it. And then with Ebony, as in Ebony Magazine, Johnson Publishing, they were at the other end of Michigan Avenue. I sold artwork to them for their permanent collection, and then I freelanced. They had a children's book called Ebony Junior. I used to do work for that.
Okay.
Then later on, I did album covers for people like Captain Sky and George Clinton. So, wherever I could make money as an illustrator, I'd try it. But I always put my rhythmistic spin on it, meaning a sense of design elements that were derived from a sort of black consciousness movement, but adapted to be able to fit the commercial mandates. So I learned illustration, printing, printmaking, graphic design from working with, some amazing graphic designers and illustrators during that period. And one thing led to another, and ultimately I decided that the comic book was a great tool. When you look at a comic book, it's amazing because it's literature and it's images. So, it has as much kinship to hieroglyphics in ancient Kemet, people call it Egypt, or ancient Nubia, or with the Aztecs, or the Ming, or the Song people. Everybody on planet Earth civilized themselves with a combination of words and pictures to tell this story, to glorify their culture. So I thought, this is a great product and art form, to really work with.
Okay.
I hope I answered one of those questions.
Actually answered like two or three of them, which is good.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because, I was going to ask you, because you brought up Kemet there for a brief minute. When you created the character Nog as the protector of the pyramids, what's the concept behind Nog? I understand you're the protector of the pyramids, but the whole concept.
Okay, I'm going to go back and I'm going to go now. Okay, going back, I was living in France. I had gone through a mood swing, which, happens with artists. You look at the world, you don't like it, so you do something. So I ended up living in France. I dropped out of college, just said, let me go over there. So I'm in the Louvre, which is, the major museum there.
Mm-hmm.
And I turn a corner in the Louvre, and there's a foot. It's a foot made out of granite. Man, this foot was about 6 or 7 feet long, and the inscription said it came from Nubia. I'm like, what the hell? If the foot is that long, how big was the statue? Okay, so it got my attention, right? We talking.
That's stolen.
We talking 1977. Got my attention, dude. I'm like, whoa. Then I look on the wall, and they have lithographs and etchings of Napoleon in his Egyptian campaign setting up cannons to shoot the face off of the Sphinx. And at the time he was there, the sand was up to the neck of the Sphinx. So they hadn't, pulled the sand away yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, I lost my mind, okay? I was like, wait a minute. Y'all doing that to my Nubian brother? So I was staying with two Jamaican sisters at that time, Yvonne and Diane, and I came home kind of, whacked out. And one of them, Yvonne, would call me, quote, a Nog. And I said, you always call me Nog. Now I know what it means. She said, what are you talking about? I said, it means Nubian of greatness. She's like, huh? So when I got back to Chicago, I looked at sketches in my sketchbooks that I had done. You know, at that time, we called it Pan-Africanism and the Black Cultural Movement, the Black Power Movement. And I was looking at all these images I had created, and I'm like, let me organize that into a comic strip. And I'm going to call it Nog, the Protector of the Pyramids, and he's going to protect planet Nuba. So my idea, it wasn't a country, but a Nubian worldview means it's a planet at stake.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ran for a while as a cartoon strip in the Chicago Defender, which was our regular daily black newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's just say we had a business problem. And when the business got exotic, I pulled the strip out and said, you know what, I'm going to publish a book. And so I go back to Paris, haven't published the book yet. And so there was a company over there called Humanoid Associés. It looks like saying the human association, but it was humanoid, like humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And this guy that was the director, Jean Gibaud, you know, I'm meeting with him. I don't realize who he really is yet, right? You know, I'm trying to get work because they produced the publication that in the United States is called Heavy Metal. But over there, it's called Mete Hurlong, which translates to screaming metal. So, you know, I'm going back and forth. And then I realized, oh, my God, this is Mobius. I'm like, oh, shit. You know, so I kind of chill out because Mobius is one of the main guys ever in the history of comic books, and particularly coming out of Europe. So he says to me, he says, why are you over here? Can't you make money in the United States? I was like, dude, I am so going back to Chicago, you know. So I just packed my bags and came back to Chicago and published Nog, the Protector of the Pyramids, as a book. And that's when I organized Only Studios from being a freelance illustrator offering service to being an independent publisher as well.
Wow.
And so with Nog, the Protector of the Pyramids, the idea is that planet Nuba is being invaded by an entity. I want people to read the books. I'm not going to say who the entity is.
They want to
steal the secrets of immortality that the Nubians have. Like, these pyramids are like vaults of information and history. And Nog is sort of like a designation. If you become Nog, your total entity is about protecting the planet and protecting the pyramids. And so the book introduces Nog, deals with the conflict. He ends up spending time on planet Earth where he meets my other characters, Malcolm Tien, Sister Girl, Sasa, and they go back with him to planet Nuba to help defend the planet because he realized that at one point, planet Earth was an outpost for planet Nuba. Like, that's how we got here.
Right.
So it weaves all this kind of mythology and pseudoscience and science all into one. And so it goes through, you know, these kind of paradigms. When I published the book, okay, before you ask the question, figure it's on your list, and I put it out, I was, you know, going through back then it was called the Pan-Africanist community, and they were like, brother, you can't do that. I'm like, wait a minute. Let's see. We got a red, black, and green cover. He's wearing a costume that looks one part Nubian and one part Dogon. He's got dreadlocks, and he's taking the pyramids punk on his chest. What is the problem? Well, see, brother, it looks like a comic book, and our people are too serious to be looking at a comic book. I'm like, dude, you are so orthodox. I don't know where you got that from. Okay? So then I went to comic book conventions, and they weren't ready for it. You know, and I'm not going to honor them by saying what the insults were. But after I digested the insults, I said, you know, this town needs an enema. No, I didn't say that. I said, this movement needs a genre. and the genre is going to be called the Black Age of Comics. So they will understand that whoever's coming in the door may be black or may be doing something that is derived from the black, African, or urban experience, and they won't be in a state of shock when they look up and find out the genius in the room is a black person.
Right.
So then that's when I launched the Black Age movement and realized there needed to be a genre and a movement. Then we could build commerce, you know, because at that point, people couldn't relate, you know.
Right. No, when you created
the
Black Age of Comics Convention in 93, right?
Right.
I'm right back in 93. And how was the reception of the Black Age in 93? I've seen old pictures, you know, from back in the day when you guys was at the, I don't know the name of the museum that you were at.
It was called the Southside Community Art Center.
Okay.
It's the last existing art center from the WPA period of the Great Depression. It was commissioned by Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, great people like Elizabeth Catlett and Charles White worked there. Margaret Burroughs, who founded the DeSalvo Museum, was there when it started. Just a lot of great people came through there. I started going through there when I was a teenager, you know. So to set the have spirits in alignment, I'm like, this is where it's got to start.
So is the Black
people like
well received?
People like, oh, look, the first one, it worked. I worked with Cassandra Washington, who was a public school educator that worked with me on the Sister Girl book. And I worked with Craig Rex Perry, who put out a book called Hip Hop Heaven. And he also had been an illustrator with Ebony Jr. And we featured Tim Jackson as one of the first artists. And it was a full-day convention. We had seminars, workshops. I would go around the country, and so I bought as many independent black books as I could find and put it out. And we put it out during February, Black History Month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back then in Chicago, February wasn't a nice month because it'd be like 20 below zero. You know,
it's never a nice month.
You know, and so then the next year we gave it, and I was like out of my mind. We had a mob scene, and Chicago had an ice storm. I mean, dude. Cars couldn't stop. They were sliding and slamming into each other. We had standing room only.
That was this year, right?
No, I'm talking about back in 94.
Okay.
So in 94, I'm like, okay, this is going to work. And so in 95, Professor William Foster came out, and he was impressed. And so then he went back east and coalesced with Jerry Craft and Yomi Oldham, and they called up, and it was really beautiful. They called up and asked my permission, you know, to do the East Coast Black Age of Comics Convention.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you ain't got to ask my, but I'm like, I love the respect of it. Because, see, the idea is, if it's a movement, you cannot own it.
Well,
you know, it's
got to
be open source. It's got to be people can get in where they fit in and interpret it based on what they bring to it.
Right.
If you own it, it's your property. It's not a movement.
Right. Well, I did the same thing.
And so,
when Yumi had approached me about doing the Black Age here in Detroit, you know, first thing I did was reached out to you to ask you, was it all right to use that name?
Yeah.
And that's when you gave me the spill on that.
Right. I mean, the respect level is tremendous. And I bring that up because the world needs to talk to us. Everybody wants to know where the positive brothers and sisters. And when I say positive, we are open to anybody that's positive. If you come to a Black Age event, it is not exclusively black people in the room.
Correct.
Okay?
Right.
Correct.
Okay, the one thing we have in common, we are talented, we are productive, we are positive. And we are creative. You got blacks, whites, Asians, disabled people, gays. You got everybody there having a good time.
Well,
and when people say, we're the positive brothers, you know, why don't black men step up? It's like, why don't y'all look up? Because we stepped up. You know, we do this every year in different markets. And we help each other, you know. You know, we agree to agree. You know, we reinforce each other's project, advocacy, program. Whenever we can, we attend each other's events. You know, so that sense of, like the principles of Kwanzaa. The Black Age manifests those principles year-round, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That we are the living embodiment of all things Kwanzaa. And so, you know, it is there. It is there. So I find it curious that even though we've got great attention, I mean, it's really ironic. I was on the E! Channel, which went out internationally, in 95 because I took a Black Age show to Crenshaw in L.A., and I'm running down what the Black Age is going to do. The Black Age has been covered in every major market, international press. So we are out here. So it's only a matter of time before investors, advertisers, collectors, educators really see the power of it. One of the things I always bring up, comic books in the Western world, United States, get stereotyped. People say, oh, man, I'm not into comic books. That's for those geeky, nerdy guys. I'm like, wait a minute, back up a minute. I'd be like, back up. Instead of saying geeky, nerdy, could you say smart, intelligent?
Well, you know that you know now, nerd or even geek is now the end thing to say. Now, I understand what you're saying as far as using the word intelligent, but when you really put it in perspective, the nerd is intelligent because everything out here that's been created and established has been established by the quote unquote geek nerd.
Geek and nerds, geek nerds and lames run the world,
right?
You know, and so when you talk. Cognitively, it's been proven by neurologists, when you are reading a comic book, your visual IQ and your literary IQ are on fire at the same time, and those are different sections of your brain. That combined cognition and how it has to integrate to keep up with the narrative, the sense of the story, because the story is illustrated and through sequential drawing, and then there's the words, there's the dialogue. That is a more rigorous exercise than if you're just reading printed word by itself or if you're just looking at pictures by themselves. That is why these geeky, nerdy, smart, intelligent guys get up on some comic books, or the guys that read comic books end up being smart, intelligent guys, because it's an incredible workout for their cognition, which is the brain and how it functions. And so,
right. So I have my answer to this, but I want you to give me your answer to this next question. You know, why do you feel that it was necessary to establish this type of event, and why do you think it's important to have black superheroes or the black hero being the focal point of the Black Age movement?
As I said, I spent time working in the music industry with, you know, doing album covers. You know, I worked on the movie Mahogany with Motown and things like that. And what I looked at, you know, like when I was a kid, you know, soul music hit, right? And they would explain, what is soul? This is soul. This is not soul. This is soul. This is not soul. They really broke down as an art form what soul was. So when you heard Otis Redding, you were like, that's soul. Okay? You knew what soul was. When James Brown decided, all right, I got to do some soul, I'm going to be soul brother number one, he had to become the epitome of an art form. Okay? And whether you were black, white, or otherwise, it was an art form. But what I looked at with Motown took care of the business. So Motown transformed the entire music industry, not just for black people, but everybody, because it was such a groundbreaking, independent company that harvested this new thing that was emerging, which was soul. So I looked at that as a template, and I'm like, why does that not exist in the art game? And so what I looked at with the potential of comic books and graphic novels is the commerce part is potentially there. Because, I mean, the other part, as a kid, my grandfather used to rent property to members of the original Nation of Islam. And I lived in the neighborhood where Elijah Muhammad was based. And the original Nation of Islam had businesses. They didn't just talk trash. and invite you to the mosque. They came out to the community. They had barbershops. They had printing press. They printed their paper. They had bakeries. So I'm looking at the model of commerce being essential to power and integrity. So, again, I'm looking at my skill set. Where do I go with this? Excuse me. And when I looked at the mainstream comic book industry, when I say looked at, I went to front offices. They didn't pay well. They ripped you off. I was like, man, y'all are so not what I thought, because I made the mistake of thinking it was like the music industry where you would get royalties. Didn't happen. But I looked at coming from a black, African, and urban perspective, it's unlimited. It's new, fresh territory, and that's important. Coming from a black consciousness standpoint, the idea of black Americans affirming themselves, coming out of slavery, saying we are a cultural force, and we have won the cultural wars, we just haven't won the commerce war. So I looked at that too and said, well, wait a minute. Here's a chance where we could control the bottom line and do the characters, do contemporary mythology. You know, like I said, my uncles were thugs. Okay, you know, shouldn't say that, but if they were sitting here, they'd be like, you right, and I was Mr. Thug to you. Okay, their father was a Pentecostal pastor that owned considerable real estate, but they chose thug life. They didn't get it at home. They got it in the culture. So it's something in the culture that appeals in a way that seduces brothers and sisters to say, I'm doing thug life. So I looked at that. You know, I'm always looking. Well, okay, I'm going to mention one of the mainstream brands, Batman. People forget Batman is called the world's greatest detective. They forget that part. That's what Batman is. He's a detective. And when Batman was created in the late 30s, John Dillinger was a folk hero. Okay? So in the white community, bank robbers were like, hey, I give you a place to stay. We won't let the coppers get you. And so they come out with Batman, and the message with Batman is crime does not pay because Batman will get you. Well, who's Batman representing? The G-Man, the government man, the FBI. It's that whole ethos. And so if you read Batman, you walk away with the moral tale that crime does not pay. Now, when you grow up, you don't remember where you got it, but you say, you know what, I don't think I'm going to be a criminal. It ain't worth it. And you would have got it from Batman when he's locking somebody up or whooping their butt and locking them up. And so in our culture, we got issues, but where's the contemporary mythology that somebody could sit and say, oh, man, wow, I never thought about that, and can make a positive change in their life. So I see that there. And of course, you could do fun. You know, trust me, I got nothing against humor. You know, you see my humor. You're going to say, brother, we... You'd be like, brother, we didn't even know you knew how to laugh. I'd be like, oh, yeah, I got that too. And so, you know, I saw it as endless potential, and I still do. The product economically, you can get your product out, you know, so you can produce the book. And I believe in growing in the public eye. If anybody knows me, I don't get negative about anybody's product at all. If you got a product, I got your back. You know, because if you don't have a product, you don't have anything to sell. Once you cross the threshold, you put out a product.
That, you know about you.
Yeah. See, I don't sit up and say, well, you know, you need a different colorist, and your 3-point perspective is really not accurate.
You get that at the mainstream conventions.
Yeah. But see, you're cultivating your style. You might have to do 10 books before you figure you out and be on it. So let's ride with you growing in the public eye. You know, it's kind of like how if you go see if you see an entertainer at the front end of their career, they don't sound like all that. You're like, okay, there's 10 of us in this club, and all right. But then later on, it's 10,000 of us in the stadium, you know. So you got to grow, and you got to have a safe space to grow in. So for me, the Black Age should be the safe space that you grow. You know, I went through a period where I would buy people's books and sell them in places, and I didn't care if I lost money. I just wanted people to know there was more going on than what I was doing. I'm like, dude, don't buy my book, but buy these. And they're
right.
Like, man, where'd that come from? I'm like, buy them. Take them home. You know, you don't like them, give them to somebody. You know, they might like them. You know, save them
right.
for ones or save them for birthdays. You know,
that's
give
true.
Them away. Put them in your class, you know. And so it's growing. You know, there used to be a time I thought I knew everybody in the Black Age. Not anymore. I don't know who's out there. I love it. I'm like, who are you? Really? You know, and you got all kind of styles. And that speaks to the growth of it. So it is growing.
That's true.
And so I think that, go ahead.
Now, Cynthia, I know you got some things you want to pose to Turtle as well. Why don't you pose those to him?
Okay. Hi, Professor Omi. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm also from Chicago. So when you were mentioning Olive Harvey, I'm like, yes, I took classes there. Our institute,
all
yes,
right.
I took classes there. I've been taught in public schools for a year, so I've been all through that area as well.
You know those little green buildings at Olive Harvey?
Yeah.
That was the whole college when I went there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was the college. Okay.
And, you know, I kind of remember when they were actually building it up, like, because it's not actually too far from where I live, because I live southeast now, and I grew up
okay.
in that area as well. So I was
right.
28 out there and all that great stuff. So, yeah. I remember,
yeah.
yeah.
Okay.
Been going there
Stony
for a long
Island,
time.
28.
Yes,
okay.
sir. Yes, sir. So you were mentioning previously about artists coming up and having to possibly develop their style, like when they first bring out their product. And I know that you coined yours as rhythmistic. So can you kind of delve into that exactly? What is rhythmistic? And, you know, how does it, you know, relate to how you approach art and also bring it out to the masses to see?
Okay. Art, like music, you know, has forms and formula. And one of the overarching design principles in art is rhythm. It's repetition. It's repetition with the pace. It's repetition with the emphasis. It's repetition with the focus. And so what I was looking at in high school, you know, keep in mind, we decided we weren't going to be Negro. We were going to be Black. Okay, and so for those of us that rolled with being Black, we were looking at how do we either create new words or put a positive spin on things that have been negative. And so what I was looking at is, it's like, okay, we have a Black art movement, but that's not good enough for me. That you don't say white art, you say, I'm going to go see Impressionism. You don't say white art, you say, I want to see Art Deco. Or I want to see Cubism, or I want to see neoclassicism. So I'm like, if the musicians can create soul music, because check it out, Black musicians all over the world, when they come up with something, they give it a name. Oh, brother, I do reggae. Oh, well, I do Afro pop. You know, well, what do you do? I do Afro beat. Well, what do you do? I do hip hop. Well, what do you do? I do free jazz. They give it names. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at our history as visual artists, and we don't articulate genre names. We'll say, well, see, man, my style is dope and your style is whack. Oh, come on, man, that's lame. That's really lame. So so I looked at the element of rhythm in my own innate work, and this is no lie. When I was in sixth grade, back then I could spell real good. You know, it really was important to me. You know, now I need spell check, right? In fact, I think my spell check needs spell check. But back then, I could spell good. So you know how in school they give you the long slip of paper to do a spelling test on?
Oh, yes, sir.
And so the teacher said, and you got an F, you failed. And I was to a state of shock. I'm like, now I know I can spell. She said, look what you did to this paper. And I had doodled all down the side of the paper, right? And I doodled in a repetitious staccato pattern. And I'm going back to my desk. I'm like, that's it. That's my style. And I from that point on, I kept all my doodles, and I would integrate elements of them into my artwork. And coming out of high school, I decided to call that approach rhythmism, And then I added to it a future primitive consciousness. I started thinking that our DNA is like your programming, and that through your DNA is every person you've ever been through the ages. It's locked in there. You just got to get it out. And so that's going from the past to the now, which is the future. So then that also puts a future primitive element. So next thing you know, I was doing science fiction from that point of view. So I see rhythmism as one part. All humanity, when you go to their primitive level, meaning their primary cultures, are very similar. The societies are more matriarchal. They try to live in more harmony with nature. You know, it's really interesting how similar they get when you go way back to their root and in the industrial phase, and now that's the future. So, you know, I see it as one part future primitive, and I see it as this nuanced area. And I hope anyone else out here, particularly anybody that's of the African or black diaspora, if they think as a visual artist they're doing something distinctive, that they give it a name as a genre so then more people can embrace it. I had somebody today say, well, brother, you're talking about putting yourself in a box. I said, absolutely not. I said, if somebody says they're a jazz musician, you don't say, well, why would you want to put yourself in a box called jazz? You know? if they say they're a jazz musician, that lets you know what to expect of them.
Right.
And then you could call up your homies and say, yo, he's a jazz musician. Let's check it out, because you want to check out jazz. So it helps to have a language of what you do. People can connect better if they're the audience, or people can connect better if they want to create in that model. So that was that. And I've experimented in commercial art, of course, in my comic books and graphic novels, in my fine art. I even worked in fashion for a while. I was a fashion illustrator, and I did wearable art. But I always put different aspects of this rhythmistic approach in the work. So sometimes it just aggressively dominates the work, but sometimes it's as subtle as like what's that insignia? What's he wearing? Like, what's that stuff over there? It's not the ground. What are you doing? You know, but it'll be some rhythmistic element that I put in the artwork to, you know, to manifest that. So I've had that as an overarching theme in my artistic practice the whole time. So thanks for asking.
Oh, problem. So you are you still very involved in like the Chicago community, like in our art festivals that would be presented, let's say, by the Savo Museum or even like, you know, the African Festival of Lights, or, you know, are you involved in that particular area as well to develop art and other artists that happen to present their art that, in that particular vein?
Okay, I want everybody to know that that question was not staged, and I did not know it was coming. Okay. Now, right. Okay. Okay. Okay.
It wasn't even written down.
I met Andre when we were set up at either the African Festival of the Arts or the DuSable Museum's annual Arts and Crafts Fest. That was where we met. He was set up. I was set up somewhere else, and I walked up on him. I'm like, wow, what are you doing? You know? And so my company, Only Studios, we used to give a freestanding convention. And now what we do, we're in a partnership with the DuSable Museum. So every summer when they give their annual Arts and Crafts Festival, we set up there. And I have guests at the tent that are operating, and we sell our books in the gift shop year-round at the DuSable Museum. I'm one of those people that, again, as a kid, I was all over the place. So when I was 17, 18, 19, I used to volunteer at the original DuSable Museum when it was in Margaret Burroughs' home in her basement. So I do that periodically. I do events with Africa International House, which are the organizers of the African Festival of the Arts here in Chicago, that's in our Washington Park area, not far from the DuSable Museum. That's usually Labor Day weekend. And
near Hyde Park.
This past fall, we had a Black Age of Comics exhibit and convention back at the Southside Community Arts Center in Bronzeville. So I still run the grid and do the connections. I'm an adjunct professor I teach drawing and art appreciation at the Harold Washington College. And if anyone knows the history of Chicago, they know the late mayor, the Honorable Harold Washington, laid the template for Obama becoming president. Okay.
Right.
When Obama came to Chicago, he was studying the whole Harold Washington phenomena and the exact same problems Obama had at the federal level in Congress was identical to what Harold Washington went through in city council here. So you know, you get this sense of power that comes out of this community. And I tell people, I'm really dedicated to and proud to be an instructor at the college that bears the name of the late Mayor Harold Washington. So I still work the grid, and I would say that the Black Age, in a lot of ways, is still underground, but it is the underground that has forced the mainstream. Anybody notice how the mainstream now is doing more black characters? I wonder why they're doing that.
Well, I know they're painting a lot of them black, but I agree with that. Now, we have like eight minutes left. We want to get a few quick questions in there.
Okay, let me say this much right quick. Everybody should go online to AfriComics.com digital and download everything. Okay.
Right.
You can get dreadlocks on there.
They
got products for free. You can get Monsters 101. You can get Nog to Protect the Pyramids. If you got a mobile device and you can hear this broadcast, you owe it to yourself to invest $5 or $6 and get 5 or 6 products and really experience the Black Age of Comics in the comfort of your home with your tablet and your phone. Okay. All right. I'm ready for the question.
Now, you may want to share that with them.
I was going to post that as well, but go ahead.
I want you to share that site with them again, because they have a whole catalog of our books on there. You know, it's AfriComics.com.
Get
everything. Now, when do you plan on doing another Black Age of Comics Con?
I'm reorganizing only studios. July 9th and 10th, we will again be in our partnership with the DuSable Museum. And I'm looking at investors and funders. We want to expand our convention model. As you know, I used to do it at the Kenwood Academy High School where I used to teach, and that was a good model. We may go back there. There's some plans to look to see if Only Studios is going to buy a building to be able to operate out of. So we're reorganizing to meet the challenge of the needs and growing. So not sure when we're going to get back in a freestanding convention, but what we're doing in partnership with the DuSable, because we still have seminars, workshops, and vendors and exhibits. So it's morphing the idea of a convention to a different format. Because being part of their Arts and Crafts Festival, they get over 3,000 people that come on the ground for free. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you a lot of potential traffic and customers that are coming through. And we get to tell people, well, brother, I understand you wasn't expecting to see us. You don't have any money. But year-round, you can go to the gift shop and buy our products. And they come back and they do just that.
I remember the year that I met you out there at the Art Festival in Chicago. It was just an amazing event for me and my partner, Kevin Hall.
That's good.
And,
yeah,
you know,
Kevin
was
all over it, man. He was like ready to explode. He was so excited.
right. He still comes out there every now and then because he does hats right now.
And
his wife. And and I told him one year I was going to get out there again. I just haven't been able to do it just yet. But we appreciate everything that you've been doing for the Black Age of Comics or whatever. I was getting ready to say for the Motor City Black Age of Comics, but I'm just going to just
it's all one and the same. We're all each other.
Exactly.
You know?
So we really appreciate you bringing it to the forefront and giving us, you know, this thought process that, you know, we all need to do this in just about every city that's possible, because right now, you know, I had a guy on my site one day not long ago, Caucasian. He had a problem with the use of the word black. He's not supporting it because it says black, and it's what he called political identity or identity politicizing, whatever he tried to say. Needless to say, I had to clear him up on that.
I tell people when you walking down the street and the sign says Chinese food, you don't say, "Oh, I'm not going there. I'm not Chinese. It must only be for Chinese people." If the sign says Mexican food, you know, if it says Mexican food, you don't say, "My mama's not from Mexico. I'm not eating no tacos." If it says Italian
and
food,
I want a taco.
Like, okay, okay, you're like I'm not going there. So if it says black, why are you tripping? You know, if it says black, it's letting you know what flavor to expect. Speaking on black, we operate an info site called blackageofcomics.com, and we average over 200,000 visitors worldwide a month. We're talking from countries like China, Latvia, Estonia, Brazil. People are looking at the Black Age on an international level on a regular basis. And what I always say to people, if somebody's doing a book and it don't look that good, buy his book. The more you buy the book, the better he's going to get.
Right.
He can't get better if you don't buy it. You got
to
buy
it. Right, exactly. Doesn't have the means to make it better.
Yeah.
Well, Cynthia, you have anything else to add to this before we get off the air?
Well, I just want to say it's been an honor listening to you, Professor Only, especially you being in my hometown as well. I've been to
Olive Harvey.
My company
you can find online is onlystudios.com. Feel free to check us out.
We're going to have you on here again because I only asked you like 3 of my questions out of 25.
Oh, man. Well, I'll come back. Just let me know. We could do this every month.
Yeah, we really can. So I'm hoping that we can see you or someone from your staff this year at the Motor City Black Age of Comics.
I'm working on that. You know, I work on doing that. That's good, man. I'm glad that you are doing this broadcast. It is incredible. I think that it gives people an opportunity to hear us talk to each other.
Right.
You know, it takes it away from being esoteric or distant. They can hear the love, the camaraderie, the energy, the appreciation, you know, the mutual admiration society that we have built. And like I said, it's room for everybody to participate if they're positive. Come on down.
That's true.
Right.
You know, we got a big old umbrella. Everybody could get under it.
There you go.
You know?
All right, well,
there you go.
I look forward to talking to you all again on the next interview. And I will talk with you all later, and I appreciate you being part of this interview tonight, Mr. Only. And I will talk to you all later. And we had a great interview.
Good. Peace, love, and prosperity to everybody.
All right, well,
good night,
everyone.
Good night.